The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
I'd like to introduce our speakers. Wyoming Tyus was born and raised in Griffin, Georgia. She attended Tennessee State University in Nashville.
Tennessee State! I love Tennessee Tigers!
And ran under the tutelage of the legendary coach Ed Temple as a member of the equally legendary Tiger Belts until she graduated in 1968. She's a four-time Olympic medalist and the holder of multiple world records and amateur athletic union championships. She was the first person ever to win the gold medal for the 100-meter sprint in two consecutive Olympics. And at the 1968 Olympics, she was also a supporter of the Olympic Project for Human Rights. And she did her part to promote justice for oppressed people around the world and also dedicated her second gold medal of that Olympics to Tommy Smith and John Carlos when they did their medal stand protest. Of course, you don't know who John Carlos is yet because I haven't done this yet. It'll all become clear in a second. As a founding member of the Women's Sports Foundation, she continues to advocate for women's equality in sports to this day. Please welcome her. Our second speaker, John Carlos, was born and raised in Harlem, New York. After graduating high school, he was awarded a full track and field scholarship to the East Texas State University, where he single-handedly won the school's first and only track and field Lone Star Conference Championship before moving to San Jose State University, where he met Tommy Smith and other participants in the Olympic Project for Human Rights. After winning the bronze medal in the 200 meters in the 1968 Mexico Olympics, I'm sure none of you have heard of this before. Carlos joined gold medal winner Tommy Smith in making Olympic history with their iconic medal stand protest. Please welcome him. And last but not least.
Oh, least. Definitely least.
Nation Magazine, and the author of 10 books on the politics of sports. He hosts the podcast Edge of Sports and is editor of Akashic Books, Edge of Sports imprint, and he will be asking the questions today. Please welcome him.
It was great to see the look on everyone's face, which was like, well, shit, we stood for the first two people. the shrug. So much to get to, and you're definitely not here to hear me. So I want to start by asking John Carlos the question that you've gotten for 50 years. And first of all, my God, it's been 50 years. And I might ask John this, he's not doing a lot of media appearances this year for his own reasons. And so the fact that he's at this conference and with us is a huge deal. So I'll throw the question, John. It's the question you've gotten for five decades, and that question is why? Why did you make that decision to raise your fist on that medal stand?
In the short term, it was necessary. I mean, there are so many people in life before me that had to deal with the same trials and tribulations as people of color in America. I look for adults to take the charge. I didn't see it coming on the collective.
The mic.
Turn it up. Turn the mic up. if you can.
Do we have a sound person?
This one. Okay, let's try that. How's that?
Well, I don't want John to keep sitting.
Don't be trying to give me no exercise. How's that?
Yeah.
Better? Yeah, as I stated, you know, as a youngster, you look at the situation in society and you look for adults to lead you through the traffic, so to speak. I looked around for adults and I saw very few next to none. So my whole role as a youngster was to see if I can get myself in position in life to make a statement or to make a difference. You know, I had a spiritual thing happen to me when I was a young kid at 7 years old. God gave me a vision. And he put me in that same scene in Mexico City as a 7 year old. I think that kind of spilled me on that much more to realize that I was being molded, so to speak, for that day in Mexico City. I feel that everyone needs a lighthouse, needs a beacon to help them stay focused in terms of as to where they're trying to go. I think we hit the nail on the head in terms of making that particular demonstration to give those individuals that's in the dark some light to see how we can deal with these situations in society. And I think, man, I appreciate that. Hey guys, do me a favor. I don't want to be rude or mean or nasty. But you know, when I get people applaud like you do, I get the hives like, you know? And I get it not to be disrespectful to you, but I feel like I'm not doing anything in terms of a showmanship. I'm not a dancer, I'm not a singer, I'm not a football player. I'm just out here trying to share to make a connection. And when you're trying to make that connection, you shouldn't have no ego to the point where you have to have applause. If anything, when you guys leave this room and you have something, you receive something from us, we applaud you. Okay? So all the applause for me. But my hero here, please extend a hearty welcome to her. Don't take it light when I say she's my hero, because I mean, I had a lot of people on that team in Mexico City that I respect. I said, but this lady here, I love her like a sister. I respect her. I respected her abilities. And more than anything, you know, it took a tremendous amount of courage on her part back at that time. Because even when she dedicated her medals to us, you have to take into account that the women were shunned from that particular activity. It was a bold thing for her to step up and do the things that she did. And for her to accomplish the things that she accomplished. I mean, she went to the 64 Olympics, won the gold medal. She didn't have to come to 68 and do nothing but win that medal and wave. But she stood with us. And now, in retrospect, when you sit back and think about her standing with us, you think to yourself, say, now how is an individual go to the Olympic Games, which is one of the greatest events on the planet, and not only win a gold medal in probably the pre-made event in the Olympic Games, 100 meters, and then come back and duplicate it, and then think it took 50 years for her to be recognized for the accomplishments that she's done. So she'll be my hero long beyond the life that I have on this planet. And support her, book. Because you want your kids, and your friends, and their kids to know about this lady. Yes.
Wyoming Tyus, 50 years ago you made that decision to dedicate your medals to John Carlos and Tommy Smith. John Carlos just referenced the way women were shut out of the Olympic Project for Human Rights. Why did you make that decision to dedicate your medals to them?
Well, I don't know if it's just one reason. I think mainly, I grew up in the South. I grew up doing the Jim Crow era. And my parents have always told us we have our rights. Everybody has rights. So I started very early also with knowing what human rights were all about. One thing they failed to, well, not so much they failed to do that. My father always told me that I could do anything I wanted to do. Just because I was a girl, didn't mean I should be stopped. And he used to tell my brothers, we grew up with three older brothers, that she has to be on your team. She has to be, you know, you can't deny her. She, matter of fact, she's better than you. So, so I started real early knowing that I had my rights, that women had rights, and it started then. And then when I went to Tennessee State, that just continued to go on. I was at a school where it was predominantly black, and I was on a track team that was all black. And these were women that were doing things, going places, and you're talking about the 50s and the 60s when that was not given to not only black people, but women. And so, and it all started there, and I started my dream there, so to speak. I was really into just being who I am, wanting to do what I like to do best. I wanted to go to college, I got a scholarship, I wanted to run track, I did that, and I don't think I was always looking at being the best. I just wanted to be a participant and be part of that. And then when it came to 68 for the Olympic Games, and we were talking about the project that all of us know about, it was nothing when it was, we were not so asked to be really a part of it. When I say we, I'm talking about women, but I was always a part of it. I felt that we all have a connection here because we're all fighting for human rights, whether it's men, women, and not only just for black people, but all minorities, not only in the U.S., but throughout the world. So that was my goal, to be a part of that, and that's why I dedicated my medals to John and Tommy, because of the fact that they had demonstrated something that I and a lot of other athletes wanted to demonstrate in the show, and they did it so powerfully. We didn't have to be on the victory stand to do it. We could do anything else. We could speak, we could say, we could do other different types of protests, which a lot of us did, and a lot of times, well, it has not been shown to the press in that. Not just me, but I wore black shorts. A lot of the men on the team, they wore black berets, they wore black shorts, they wore socks, boots, pants, all those kinds of things. And in the protests, and also to honor what Carlos and Tommy did. So that's why I did it. Mm.
Now, Dr. John, a lot of folks did not stand with you in 1968 the way Wyoming Tides did. And I was wondering, now 50 years later, what is your perspective on your fellow Olympians who saw what you did and made the decision to not step up? How are you thinking about these folks today, and have those thoughts changed over the 50 years?
Oh man, you know, I can say it in one word, and that's L-O-V-E, love. I mean, I have as much love for those individuals today as I had yesterday. Well, it's a complicated situation. You sit back and you think about the time of 1968. I mean, this was a universal situation, and it's a universal, I'm talking about worldwide. Everyone was fighting for rights. Everyone from China to Asia to America to Holland, understand? Or South Georgia, where this young lady's from. So when you sit back and you say, the guys, we wanted them to boycott, now how do you guys out there train every day to do whatever your job is, and I walk up and I tell you, say, hey man, I want you to forget about your job, we're gonna boycott your job. That's a heavy statement. You've been working to get in this position all your life, and now I hear a guy like John Collins come and say, I want you to sacrifice that opportunity you had for your 15 minutes in the sun. My estimation in terms of the divide was, I think I had an inside track mentally in terms of how deep this race issue was in the United States. See, because I'm the type of guy, when I was a little kid, I went to elders to learn. I didn't roll with the kids my age. So by the time I became a young adult and had my kids, my life was passé. My focus was on the life of my kids. And I tried to make those individuals that I'm asking to sacrifice these games to focus on their kids. Because anything that I did in terms of a boycott or in terms of putting my fist to the sky, it was relegated towards the children that was coming behind us. Particularly black kids, but in general, all kids. We had to create an opportunity for them to blend in like that at a salad bowl or the fruit bowl. The only way you can do that is to be organized. But I can't knock a guy because a guy say, man, that's a heavy thing you want me to do. You want me to sacrifice. I promise my church, my parents are looking for me to go to the Olympics. My kids are expecting me to come home with a medal. It's difficult. And then at the same time, you have to take into account that we had a thing called a fear factor. Mm-hmm. Many individuals felt like if I boycott the Olympic Games at the peak, at the height of my career, I may never get a job in America again. And when you sit back and think about that, flip it back to 2018. We have a lot of individuals right now in that same situation. They're at the crossroads because someone's telling them to take a knee. And a lot of guys are thinking, say, man, if I take a knee, I may never play football again. But it's not about football. It's not about the Olympic Games. It's about humanity. And I think that should be the main focus. And I can't knock an individual down what he didn't know then, because everyone is not born to be on the same page at the same day. Certain people have to grow into it. 50 years later, and I challenged Dave the other day, he's in my room, and I challenged Dave and told Dave, said, what I'd like to do is get spread individuals that was on the 6K team, various ethnic groups, various sexual gender, and put them together. And let's have some dialogue and let the athletes themselves express to you the turmoil that they was going through when that decision was put upon them. Because I asked you the same question. What would you do? Out of the whole stack of you, it might be less than 1% that would step up and say, man, bar none, I would make that statement. But in the heat of the moment, that's a scary thing to do. I mean, they looked at Tommy Smith, they looked at John Carlson, they looked at Peter Norman, and they looked at people that was associated with us, that was friendly towards us. They looked at them, step away from us. Why'd they step away? Not because they didn't love us. And it took a minute for me to realize that. They didn't step away because they didn't like me. They stepped away because they had fear of reprisal for being associated with me. But I didn't concern about that. What I was concerned about is make sure that my kids didn't have to sleep in the park. Or I didn't have to move out of the house that I had. You know, I'm a thug out of New York. Ain't no fans and busting by. I was gonna be a gangster. Until God put in my head, I got some better things for you to do. But when you sit back and you think about your kids and what you're going to do for your kids, going to Mexico City and saying I'm going to make a universal statement, that was a minor thing for me. Everybody said, oh, it was such a great thing. I was born to go to Mexico City in 1968. That was my chore in life. God bless me now when people walk around and say, oh, man, you're a living icon, you're a legend, you this, you that. That ain't nothing but your brother. No more, no less. But it's humbling, you know, when people get up, like when I come in here and you guys applaud, like the other night when Dave introduced me to Big Farm we had. Man, do you know how it is when people give you the love that you guys expose? All I can do is just throw kisses at you because I don't know what to say. All I can say is give it all back. That's the essence of saying I'm willing to be a sacrificial lamb to make society better for all people. You know, think about how many people were just stuck up in a situation like we were as dead as a result. We didn't care about dying. I know the guys that was in the hood with us that was right there in San Jose State, we didn't care about whether we died because I had a two, well, if you take my life, you can't take the precedent away. That will live forever. So guys, it was necessary. Those guys right now, if you ask every last one of them, what's your take 50 years later? You think you made the right decision? I bet 99.9% of them say, no, man, I wish I was the man yesterday that I am today. And that's it. Security. Get on the job.
Well, I have some back-to-back questions for you, but just first, did you also feel that fear factor in 1968? What were your thoughts about the people who didn't do what you did, I mean, what, and has, have those feelings changed over 50 years?
I think when you look at it, you have to look at people, we're all on different pages. We all may not be on the same page at the same time. And when I look at that, where I was, and it's being at Tennessee State, and being on the Coast Temple, and the way we, it was more like, well, you know, you train all these years to go to the Olympics and hopefully win a medal or, you know, just participate, whichever one. And that he wanted us to make our own decision. It was for us to make the decision. He didn't have any choice. He said, you make your decision because you're going to have to live with it for the rest of your life, whatever you do. When I decided to dedicate my medal to, like I said earlier, to Tommy and John, I dedicated because of what I believe in, and what I believe in is equal rights for all. And I'm also that part of that equal rights is definitely equal rights for women. Because I look at it now, we're in 2018, and I think about being 50 years late, 50 years ago, the same things I was fighting for women, the same thing I was fighting for equal rights is still happening right now. So yeah, I was there. I mean, now, so, you know, when I look at other people, if they didn't take a stand, I figured they would get up, they would be with me. Not so much they would not be with me. It may take them another year, it may take them another month. Something may happen for them that happened for me, that changed their lives, that made them think, hey, I need to be with the movement, I need to say these things, I need to speak out. And that's how it was for me. I, you know, growing up, it's like, I can't tell you enough, growing up and saying, hey, you can't do this because you're black, you can't do this because you're a woman. I mean, my father always said, you can always do it. You just have to stay in the fight. And that's what I did, I stayed in the fight. And to me, what Carlos and Tommy did, no one else could do that. Everybody protested their own way, but there was a lot of support for them. And also the athletes that did not protest, or did not, they came back to America and still had the same kind, not mad at it, not as much as they did, but they were discriminated against just as much as Carlos and Tommy were. They couldn't get their jobs, people looked at them different. All you had your community saying to you, why you didn't do more? So, you know, you had both ends going. So you always have to be, I always think you have to always say, hey, they went on the page I was on. There's nothing wrong with that. Everybody here, you may not be on the same page, but we look at, we're trying to get you there. We're educating you. We're making sure that you know, like, what you can do and cannot.
Thank you.
Okay, just, I want, before we went any further, this book is fantastic. It's Wyoming with Elizabeth. They wrote this book, Tiger Bell, the Wyoming Ties Story. And I didn't want to go any further in this discussion without Wyoming answering the question about what the heck a tiger bell is and what their significance is, not just to the history of black women in sports, but their significance to the history of sports on the whole. Because it really is remarkable. So, what's a tiger bell?
Why are you looking at one? But no, they, at Tennessee State University, they you know, like when all schools have mascots, and we were all on the track team. Instead of us being the Tigerettes or something like that, one of the people that were very close to Mr. Temple, who was a photographer for our team, he wanted to name us the Tiger Bells, and that's how we got the name Tiger Bells. And Tiger Bell encompass what Mr. Temple would say is that he always said you're ladies first and you're an athlete. And the key thing he wanted is that for all his girls to graduate from college, that was the key thing, whether you went to the Olympics or whether you not. And a lot of girls on the team did not get a chance to go to the Olympics, although he put 40 Olympians. There were 40 people on the team, and out of the 40, it was 23 gold medals. But,
gotta say that again. I mean,
there were 40 girls that made Olympic teams from 1952 to 1984. And all of them, and out of those 40, 23 gold medals. and I think her team of them were like silver and armor with bronze. And that the most remarkable thing that truly makes, what I think makes a tiger build is the fact that every young lady that came under Mr. Temple graduated from college with a degree. That is the goal that every woman, that we all get an education in, because education is the key. Because if you're educated, nobody can take that from you, and you can always be able to speak on situations. And you can, what his favorite thing was, that track or sports will open the door, education will keep the door open. And in fact, he wanted us to do that, and that is his emphasis. And whether you made an Olympic team or not, he made sure those young ladies that were not part of the 40 got a chance to go to college and get an education. So being a Tigerville is a person that, well-rounded, I would like to say, a person that had dreams and goals of being more than an athlete and looking to change the world in some way.
Mm. Yeah. And
what Todd said, I just want to add on to it in terms of the Tiger Bells and in terms of Coach Temple. See, Todd just said that out of 40 athletes that went to the Olympic Games from Tennessee State, 23 of them won gold medals. So that means that the coach must have knew something. This guy had to have some kind of wisdom in his heart about this sport. Now to say that, to think about, you're dealing with racism in the South. You're bringing all these black women to the South, a little small university. You raise them up to that level. You go to the Olympic Games and you win an enormous amount of medals. And yet and still, dealing with racism, when it came time for them to pick the head coach for the team in 1964, was it 64?
Yeah.
1964. Instead of them outright saying, Coach Temple, you're the coach of the women's team, merely because of the color of his skin, they was getting ready to push him to the side. Yeah, we're going to take your girls because they're going to represent America and win. And mind you, the Tiger Bells won more medals than most countries won. Not just, you know, the fact that they won 24, they won more than most countries. And then they're going to tell this coach, man, you're not going to be the head coach. Well, I admire Coach Temple because Coach Temple took a stand like I did in Mexico. Coach Temple pulled him on the side. He could have been, you know, passive like all the rest of the coaches, but he pulled him on the side and he told him, he said, let me tell you something. I don't know who you're talking about that you're going to put in this job over me, but I'm going to tell you, if I don't get the nod, I guarantee none of these girls from Tennessee State are going to be going to the Olympic Games. Message registered. Because when it came out, man, it was not on the sheet to be the coach. He wanted to be the head coach. So, you know, you have to step up to the plate when it's time to step up to the plate. I don't mind dealing with racism. Ty didn't mind dealing with racism because racism didn't stop us from representing America. We went all around the world with the USA on our chest. There was applauding there, oh, yippee-ki-yay, we got our guys representing us. But that means that there's only one side of the street. The other side is when we come home, and certain individuals that say, man, I'm going to deal with the issues other than what I had to deal with on the track. And most people don't have a clue in terms of how much pressure these athletes had on them in 1968. Mm-hmm. Think about the pressures they had. They had pressure because the government is telling them, don't you misbehave. Avery Bronson is telling them, say, if you do one thing, we're going to expel the whole team. Then you sit back and you say, now you got feuds in your house because now you're talking about a boycott, and your wife is in there saying, well, honey, is that the right thing to do? Should we do that? Because it looks like we're rising, and if we do that, it's going to hurt. So there's a lot of pressure on athletes. But mind you, in the performance that took place in 1968 at those Olympic Games, was greater than any Olympics in history. And they had a lot of great Olympians. But think about the pressure on this side, and it was very high. But think about the height of the athletic abilities they exposed that day, or during that 10 days. They set world records that still stands today. You understand? They might not like you because of who you are, what your color, like in Mexico City, and Ty can attest to this. When it came time for them to say, we're going to kick Tommy Smith and John Collins off the team, they didn't say go up there and pull that medal count down. They left our medal count up there. So you can't have it both ways. You can't kick me off the team and then want to take credit for what I did too. But they would do it if you allow them to do it. And that's what I love and respect about you guys, because where they think they're going to get a free ride, you tell them, say, no, I'm not going to allow you to get no free ride today. Sorry, Dave, I just had to drop that little tip.
No, that's I did want to ask you about the civil rights movement, Dr. King, and the black freedom struggle. I mean, it takes such tunnel vision and such focus to be an Olympian. And you're winning back-to-back goals in 64 and 68. How aware were you that these struggles were raging in the South all around you, and how did it affect you?
Well, it goes back to, I grew up in the South. I grew up doing Jim Crow era, so all of that was that. I grew up, you know, going in to the small town of Griffin, Georgia, which not that big. And you go into the drugstore there, and whatever the business there, and you got colored on one side and white on the other. And our biggest goal when we were kids was just to turn both waters on and see which one is going to come out what color. Head colored here and white. So that's pretty much how I grew up with that. And with Martin Luther King, or Dr. Martin Luther King, all the things that he was saying were all the things that I felt my parents were saying to us, but not out loudly to the world, but to us, that you have rights again. You should not give up what you believe in. You should always fight for what you believe in. And by the time I went off to college and Tennessee State, I felt the same type of power that my parents had given me, because I had Coach Temple doing the same thing. And then, not only that, you had Dr. Martin Luther King saying it to the world. So you felt like you had forces and people that believed like you and wanted to see a change happen in the world, because it was definitely time for change. And a lot of people knew that they were still sticking to their old guns, especially in the South. But I felt that Dr. Martin Luther King really made great strides in reaching a whole group of people, not just black people, but a lot of different races. And that's what kept the movement going. And I think anytime, again, we have somebody really pushing, somebody really stepping out on their own and saying, this needs to change, then you get a lot of people start to look at it and say, what can I do? What is my role in this? And I think he was a person that could show you a role that. And he took nonviolence role. A lot of people not nonviolent. You know, a lot of people can't sit at the counter and be hit and spit on and all that. I was one of those. But I felt I could do other things. I could help the movement in another way. I mean, I can't sit and take, it just was not in me. My parents didn't raise me that way. So my movement, for me then, it was for speaking out when I had an opportunity, and it's still that, for speaking out.
You should also just say, like, when you say you weren't made to do that, what would have happened if someone had spit on you? Just so people are clear on what you're saying.
Well, Elizabeth knows, because we talk about it in the book, but we would never let anything like that. I would never let anybody spit around, touch me, hit me. My parents brought us up. If someone just does that, you in for a fight, and that's what it was. One thing that really happened, my brothers used to say all the time to me, you have to stay in the fight, even if you're getting beat, you have to stay in the fight so the person know they at least win a war. So.
And one follow-up question. One thing, when this book was announced, I got all this emails from young black women who are doing graduate work in sports and sports history, and they were just like, thank you, this history has not been written. Thank you that this is happening. When can I get an advanced copy? And I wanted to ask you, how does it feel now, 50 years later? Is it, because I know, you know, you had to be coaxed a little bit to even do in the book, truth be told. Yeah. So how does it feel to see this interest in your story from a new generation of people? Is it something that's surprising to you? Is it gratifying? But what are your thoughts now?
Well, it's all those things you just said and probably 10 things more. But before I even answer that, I would just like to say too, that thanks to Dave for introducing me to Elizabeth, who is a co-writers and making this book happen. She had to push me a lot for a lot of things, and because I look at my life and the things I've done is that I did them because it's something I believe in, something I want people to see, and I always told Elizabeth, one thing about history, you can't erase it. You know, they somewhere along the line, they're going to have to look down, and maybe they have to start here and come all the way down, but they're going to see a, you know, why Matthias did these kinds of things. She was in the Olympics, she won, she was the first person to win gold medal back to back in 100 meters. And for me, that was, when I see people talking about it now, and people saying to me that, you know, you're an activist, and you're this, and I just feel like, no, I'm just doing what's right, what feels right for me. I'm like this, if it doesn't feel right, it ain't right. If it feels right, you keep doing it, and that's what it has always been. I'm just glad that Elizabeth has given me a voice, so to speak, and for people to also to know that, you know, there have been women on the march and really fighting for equal rights, not just for people of color, but for women in general. And I think that for me, growing up and not having that encouragement, having people say, you know, muscles are ugly on women and all these kinds of things, and I could fight through that. I figured if I could fight through that, this day and time, each and every person out there, woman out there, should be able to fight through any little thing. So.
Yeah. John, similar question to you. I remember when we first started talking, which was, I couldn't believe it when I was looking it up. It was about 15, 16 years ago when we first started talking. And I remember at that time, you felt very much on the outside looking in of the sports world. And now it's just wild. 15 years later, people are calling your phone off the hook. People want to do interviews with you. You've made your own stand where you're trying to do as few as interviews as possible, even with the 50th anniversary, which is just driving some of these reporters crazy. Maybe that's your intention. driving them to fits of distraction. And I want to, yeah, he played me a couple of the voicemails. It wasn't pretty. and so I wanted to ask you, John, like, how do you feel 50 years later, after so many years in the wilderness, to be getting this kind of attention and appreciation?
Well, you know, talking about books, I would have to say the book was a big thing for me in terms of putting my story out there, because I think for the first 35 years, 38 years, somewhere around that number, I would give my story, and by the time I read my story, or by the time I saw a documentary, my story turned into their story, okay? So then it was imperative for me to say, man, I don't know how much time I have on this planet, but the only way I'm gonna set the record straight is for me to put my thoughts on paper. This is from me. They can't change what I said on paper. All they can do is dictate what they wanna do their story about me, then they can put in what they wanna put in. But when I write a book, they can't change it. I think that book in itself enlightened a lot of people and woke a lot of people up in terms of who John Carlos is, because they had painted me as a two-headed dragon for so long. I'm a hate-monger, and I don't like white folks, and I don't like America. I mean, they've been talking like this forever. But it didn't change who I am. My attitude is that I have my eyes on the prize, and no one is going to change me away from who I am and where I'm trying to go with my life. So, you know, a lot of people tell me about I'm an inspiration to them. I think I'm an inspiration based on the fact that I'm not a quitter. I don't give up until the job is done. And you know, you don't look at me in terms of saying, well, this guy, man, he has a nasty attitude. Most people that run into me, they're gonna see I'm a pleasant guy, I'm a happy-go-lucky guy, I like to see people smile, I don't like to see people hurt. I think talking about hurt, that's why one of the reasons why I stayed in the track and field. Because I'm a colorful type guy, and when I went into track and field in my neighborhood, there was a lot of people that was concerned about where am I gonna get the rent money from to pay my rent. How am I gonna get my kids graduation cap and gown? How am I gonna have groceries for the cabinet? So when I went out and started running track, it wasn't about running track. It was about giving the people that spend that money to come in the stands something they hadn't seen before. So my attitude was about, you know, more than track and field, let's give them some showmanship. And I think that showmanship gelled with my history and my knowledge and so forth, and being steadfast going to the prize. I think this is when people started waking up and realizing that Carlos is maybe a unique individual. I don't like to say that I'm unique as much as I like to say I'm your brother. And we can do this together. I can't do it by myself. When Todd did what she did in 68 and said, I'll stand with you, she stood with me when guys that was on the team that I trained with every day didn't stand, but she stood. I didn't need the rest of them because I had her. And then I find out in 50 years how many people stood next to Ty that were standing with me as well. So I know I'm on the right track. You know I'm on the right track. You know that we're on the right track. And you're going to pass it out to the rest of the world and let them know that they can jump on the same train. Mm-hmm. You're about to get fired.
As we begin to wrap up this part, I have two more questions for each of you. And that has to do with what's happening today with this new generation of athletes taking a knee, raising a fist, sitting down, and basically trying to make their voices heard. And they've gotten such a ferocious backlash from people in the media, from the Fox News right wing, and from this president. His comments about them, I can't even say in public. And I wanted to ask you first, Wyoming, what is all this anti-athlete activism about? Where do you think that comes from? Why do you think that upsets people so much, the idea of these athletes expressing themselves?
I don't know if there's one answer to it. I mean, I think it's tons of things. You know, it keeps being thrown out there by certain people that athletes are just go out there and participate and they act like we don't have a brain or we don't think girls, and we do. And in this day and time, we have a great many athletes that are really aware of what's going on, not only in America, but what's going on in the world. And when it happened in 68, you only had a handful of people. Then you have a lot more. And to me, when you get a lot more involved in it, then you have a lot more power. I think now that people, I sometimes look back and say, oh gosh, we're just going back to the 60s. That's all that's happening. They want to take all these things. You're not to say this, you have to go and be nice to people and participate in whatever sport you are participating in and come back to home and be just happy and go to the White House and have lunch or whatever. Or not go. I just think that, you know, people are more aware and we're more educated, and people are more willing to be involved and stand up for rights for not just themselves, but for everybody. And also to be able to say, I stand with you. And if we all stand together, we can make a change. You know, it's when you're a lot of numbers, it's very difficult. I think athletes are seeing that, not only just the adult athletes, we see that in the young people that are athletes. They are making a stand as young, and it starts at home, it starts when you're young and you are educated know. And not only that, you see things that are happening with your own eyes, you know that are wrong. And if it's wrong, then again, if it doesn't feel right, it's not right. If it doesn't look right, it's definitely not right. So, and that's, I think those are, that's something we all have to look at. If it's not feeling right, not, it does look right, and all those things, we all have to be involved. And I think that's what's happening with the new breed of athlete. And I'm welcoming to see this. I'm happy to see that we have these athletes that can do more than play ball or run track or jump, gymnastics or whatever sport they're in, and that they are able to speak out and people are listening and definitely being with them.
Mm. Same question to you, John. What do you think is behind the backlash? I mean, these athletes, they're expressing rights that they should not even have to defend. And yet, that shouldn't even be a question that they have the right to speak out. And yet, that's fundamentally what the Fox News is, the president, I mean, talking about. They should be fired for what they're doing. They should be sent out of the country. I mean, what is that about?
Well, first of all, you know, you have to take into account, you know, 50 years going by, and when I sit back in retrospect, I think about, when I talk about the athletes having a fair factor, 50 years later, I realize that it flipped on both sides of the street. Because the government, the United States government, had a fair factor as well. Because when we got up on the victory stand and we made our statement, it was a universal thing. They couldn't cover it up, they couldn't pull the shade down, they couldn't pull the plug, it was there, open, raw. Everyone had an opportunity to see it and then digest in their minds and think for themselves for the first time what this is. I like to tell people, say, you know, Tommy Smith, Peter Norman, and John Collins, we were the first internet. We went around the world instantaneously. But then when you sit back and think about the government had fear about what we did, and they sitting back for 50 years and say, man, we tried and buried this thing. Every way we tried and buried it. We tried and buried it. Every year it came back stronger and stronger and stronger. So now when you sit back on the other side, you sit back and say, well, these young individuals today, and it's not just merely the athletes themselves, we have people in the arts that have a lot more sincerity about human rights and social issues and so forth. We got singers, we got dancers, we got movie stars that are stepping up to speak out now. Those individuals, along with the football players, that's the fruit of our labor. When we planted seeds 50 years ago about society and how society should make these changes, it's necessary to make these changes for us to be harmonious together and have some love and understanding and progressions. They said, oh, we got it. They didn't, you know, tell a story about the picture. If you saw the picture of the demonstration, if you saw your kid's history book and you saw that picture in the book, they didn't put the picture in the book and then have some dialogue about what this picture represented. They just had 2-3 lines on the picture. But the picture was so compelling until the kids say, man, I'm not going for this little 3 lines. Who is this and what is this about? And if you're not gonna tell me, I'm gonna find out myself. So when you see these individuals now, they're the fruit of our labor. So you sit back now, you see a guy like Donald Trump come into office. Donald Trump realized the power of 50 years ago, so he's trying to do everything he can right now to stop this fire that's getting ready to burn. Okay? He's trying to put as much water on it as he can with intimidation, with division. And then he ain't just trying to divide the athletes against themselves, he's trying to divide America against itself. Everyone around here in America feels uncomfortable. Not merely because the individual say, I choose to take a knee. I'm not disrespecting the flag. He took a knee because he was concerned about police brutality, police homicides. Mm-hmm. But they took a spin, put a spin on it and said, oh, he's anti-America. He's anti the anthem. Well, we could go into the anthem and have some policies about that as well. But that wasn't an issue that particular day. Okay? So when you sit back and think about why it is the way it is, it's because they have the fear factor because the social movement is rising.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org. a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.